We saw how we could characterize some characterize stochastic processes or random signals using some statistical measures, and let us look at some properties of stochastic processes or random processes. A random process is stationary if its statistics remain the same over time. If you make an observation at this point in time, and later again, and later again, if the properties remain the same, then it is a stationary process. There are two definitions. One says stationarity in the strict sense, or strongly stationary, if all of its statistics are not affected by a shift in the origin in time. In the book I said they are not functions of time. I meant they do not vary with time. But of course, autocorrelation is a function of time. So that definition, that the wording in the book is wrong. You should consider this definition, which says explicitly, a shift in time does not affect the statistics. So whether you compute the statistics here or some other point in time or make an observation tomorrow, if they remain the same, then the process is stationary. So what we wrote earlier as mu x t1, you don't have to put the time argument, it is simply mu x, and phi x t1 t1 plus tau, it's not a function of t1 anymore, the reference point, instead is a function of this difference tau only. So the autocorrelation function becomes a function of only the shift between the two points in time that you're considering. So the ACF is a function of the delay parameter tau. The path spectral density then does not vary with time. The path spectral density is also a statistical measure in the sense it is related to the autocorrelation function via the Fourier transform. So the path spectral density does not change with time. So the spectrum is the same for various observations along time. So it is stationary in that sense. A stationary process is ergodic, which I mentioned earlier, if the temporal statistics are independent of the sample observed. So whether you compute statistics along time or across samples or observations of the stochastic process, the result will be the same. So if the temporal statistics are equal to the ensemble statistics, then the process is said to be ergodic. Quite often we make the when you do not have an ensemble, you make the assumption of ergodicity and compute temporal statistics from the single signal or observation available to you. Time averages are then independent of k, the sample number of the observation. When I say sample, we should say, perhaps I should say more clearly, the observation number, because sample could also be along the time. So mu xk is simply mu x, and phi xx tau k is just phi xx tau. It doesn't matter which sample observation we are talking about. All ensemble statistics may be replaced by temporal statistics when analyzing ergodic processes. An ergodic process, it's an important type of stationary random process since the statistics may be computed from a single observation as a function of time. And quite often that is the situation. Signals or processes that do not meet the conditions described above are called non-stationary processes. A non-stationary process possesses statistics that change with time, such as the mean, the variance, the autocorrelation function, the path spectral density. If they keep changing with time, then the signal or process is a non-stationary process. Obviously, the speech signal is non-stationary. We have voice sounds, unvoiced sounds, plosives, fricatives, and so on. The pitch changes. The spectral content will change. That is what makes the speech interesting, regardless of the technical content. Speech has a time-varying characteristic. The same with heart sounds. The characteristics of the first heart sound are different from those of the second heart sound. The characteristics of murmurs are different from those of the heart sounds. I did not mention one other point. I gave the definition of a process that is stationary in the strict sense. But wide sense stationarity is another term that is used to indicate processes that have the mean and the standard deviation or the variance independent of time, that do not vary with time. So if only the first and second order statistics are independent of time, then the process is said to be stationary in the wide sense. Or you may say second order stationarity. So here is the speech signal again. And this is the variance computed in a small window. I used a window of 50 milliseconds or 400 samples. And the variance is a second order statistical measure. And the variance is clearly changing. There is high variance for the voiced sound because of the large amplitude swing for the A and E sounds. So this indicates variance is changing over time, and hence it is not stationary in the second order statistical measure of variance. Of course, the power spectral density also is changing. We're not interested in the mean. If you go back here, the mean is the same, zero. So it is stationary in the mean, but we don't consider mean to be important here. In fact, being an acoustic signal, the mean has no meaning because constant pressure has no sound signal associated with it. I mentioned several times, I keep repeating, that most biomedical systems are dynamic and they create non-stationary signals, such as the EMG, the EEG, the VMG, the PCG, the VAG, speech, and so on. The ECG, it's a rhythmic signal, and we don't really look at the spectrum much, although you could possibly compute the spectrum. You cannot call it a stationary signal, but we do not consider the variance and the mean. The spectrum is used as an estimate of bandwidth, and it typically does not change much. If there are ectopic beats, there could be a small change in the power spectrum, but there is no major change in the power spectral density characteristics of the ECG. So the ECG could be said to be fairly stationary. So I didn't put the ECG here. Having said that these signals and systems are non-stationary, they are physical systems, and physical or physiological systems typically have some maximum rate at which they could possibly change. I can change the characteristics of my vocal tract at a certain rate. I can speak fast. In India, we speak fairly fast, and after moving to Canada, I had to learn to speak slower and slower and slower to be intelligible and to be understood by the others. But regardless of how fast I could possibly speak, there is a certain rate of change associated with the change of the vocal tract shape. I cannot change it in the order of microseconds. I can change it in the order of a fraction of a second, maybe of the order of a few milliseconds. So there is a rate of change that has some limit, or there is a limited rate of change of the characteristics, which leads to the possibility of segmenting the signal into parts and say from here to here the signal has a certain characteristics and the vocal cords or the vocal tract were held in a certain position. So you can say that the signal or the system is stationary within that interval. Excuse me, I want to go back here. So you could say while my system is producing the signal S or S in safety, for this portion, the system is stationary, it is held in the same position, the same sound is coming. So overall the system and the signal are non-stationary and time varying, but over this much of the time, it is stationary. And from here to here, while I'm saying A for safety, it is stationary. The frequency characteristics are the same. the resonance characteristics are the same because I'm producing the same sound, A, and so on. So if you can break this into parts for the S sound, the A sound, the F sound, T is a transient, a plosive. So if you want, I can segment and say this is T, and then E. Then you can say in these parts, the system and the signal are stationary or quasi-stationary, almost stationary. So then you can break the signal into segments of short duration, not necessarily fixed. You could break into fixed parts, or it is better to break into adaptive parts, identifying the changes that are happening and drawing boundaries wherever there is a change. And then within these intervals, the statistics of interest are not varying and may be assumed to remain the same, and the signal and system then are stationary in those intervals. This facilitates what is called quasi-stationary, quasi-stationary or short-time analysis. Short-time meaning within that window you are analyzing something and you are getting some parameters. And then in the next window you extract another set of parameters. Now with speech signals, you could compute the power spectral density over such adaptive segments, or it is common to use fixed segments if you do not have the techniques to break the signal into adaptive parts. Then you take a short window and you slide point by point, or you slide every 5 milliseconds or 10 milliseconds and compute the spectrum. And here we have the spectrogram of the same speech signal, safety. Here is S, and this is A, and F, and T, and E at the end. So this is a wide band signal with energy coming up to a few kilohertz. Here you have mainly low frequency formants related to the vowel A. Here again you have the unvoiced F signal, which is also almost random. And then, and that is here, this is the T, the plosive, because it's a like an impulsive signal. Again, you have broadband. And then you have the formants related to E at the end. So you can see that the spectrum is changing with time. So this is non-stationary in frequency content. The heart sound signal and other signals associated with the cardiac system have some interesting characteristics. The signals are non-stationary within a cardiac cycle, but the same thing happens from one beat to the next to the next to the next, because the heart keeps doing the same thing in a rhythmic, repetitive manner. So this leads to an interesting concept known as cyclostationary signals. The cardiac system performs rhythmic operation. The ECG, PCG, carotid pulse, they are quasi-periodic, almost periodic. But if you were to consider the various activities within one cycle of the heart sound or PCG signal, S1 is different from S2. If there is a murmur, it is different from the S1 and S2 sounds. But the same S1 comes again in the next cycle and again and again and again. The same murmur will repeat. So these are repetitive or cyclostationary characteristics. The cardiac structures will be in the same position again and again. So the statistics of the PCG vary within the duration of a cardiac cycle, especially when there are murmurs, but repeat themselves at regular intervals, not exactly periodic. So if you could use the ECG as a trigger, you can identify the same cardiac phase from one cycle to another, and then you can derive characteristics or measurements from these, or measures of the signal, features of the signal from such segments from beat to beat to beat. Cyclic repetition facilitates ensemble averaging. So even though there is only one signal given to you as a function of time, if you can cut them beat to beat, You can have one beat, the next, and you have an ensemble of beats from the same patient or subject. Then you can perform ensemble statistics and averaging and get better estimates of the statistical measures you wish to derive. So using epochs or events extracted from an observation of a signal many times, then you can perform ensemble averaging. This is the same as what I showed earlier with the event-related potentials. Flashes of light are given, and the response from the brain is recorded. The stimulus rate is under your control, experimental control, could be exactly periodic or not necessarily. As long as you align the responses at the same instant as the stimulus, you can perform averaging, not only of the signal, but also of features that you derive from the signal, such as power spectral density and other measures. You could do that also with heart sound. The trigger is not under your control. The trigger is controlled by the sinoatrial node. But you can get the ECG signal, which gives a clear marker, the QRS marker, which is not the SA node, but contraction of the ventricle. You can use that as a marker and cut the heart sound signal into cycles, successive cardiac cycles. You may reject some if they are noisy or not good. Keep the good ones, derive your measures, and take an ensemble average. Of course, if you just average the heart sounds, even if you do synchronized averaging, the net result will be almost zero because these vibrations are almost random signals and they cancel out, and time domain averaging of multiple heart sound signals would not be useful. For sure, the murmurs will cancel out because they are random. Even an S1 and S2 signals may cancel out because they're not exactly in phase and the waveforms vary from one beat to another. Event-related potentials may be averaged in the time domain directly for benefit, not heart sounds, not EMG, not VMG, not vibration signals, because they do not have a specific waveform. So let's take a few case studies and examples of artifacts present in biomedical signals. Noise in event-related potentials, I said earlier and mentioned just now, ERP is a signal obtained in response to a stimulus. The response is typically of the order of a few microvolts, buried in ambient EEG, ongoing activity and noise, and a single response may not be recognizable in the recording. So what I showed earlier are 10 flash ERP signals, and the averaging was used to cancel the artifacts present. I don't have to go back to that, I presume. You remember that from the morning, so I'll skip that. High-frequency noise in the ECG is quite common due to instrumentation artifacts. Could also be due to muscle contraction and the EMG if the patient moves. Power line artifact at 60 Hz is structured noise, but the bandwidth of the ECG is fairly low, limited to about 50 Hz, maybe a little more than 50. But most of the energy of an ECG signal is below about 40, 50 Hz. So relative to that, 60 Hz is high frequency. So one could say even power line artifact and its harmonics could be treated as high frequency noise. So here is an ECG signal where there is considerable high frequency noise. Motion artifact in the ECG, sometimes motion artifact could appear as low frequency, what is called baseline drift. So instead of the ECG remaining steady, it may go up and down. The reference line could move up and down. And then this is known as a baseline artifact or baseline drift. When you're using chest leads, it could be caused by breathing. And by breathing, the electrodes could move or the contact of the electrode with the chest could be affected. And coughing could lead to both high frequency and low frequency noise. Or when an arm or leg is moved, in the case of limb bleed ECG, there could be some movement of the baseline or the reference line. EGG is another source of artifact. This is electrogastrogram. And poor contact and polarization of the electrodes will also lead to low frequency artifacts. So here is an example, I'll come back to the other page, where the baseline is going up and down. Normally, it should have been flat at zero. So there is also high frequency noise you can see here, and also low frequency artifact. Baseline drift is also caused by variations in temperature and bias in the instrumentation and amplifiers. If the reference is changing, then that could lead to a slow variation of the baseline. The problem caused by baseline drift is important. It is important to recognize the existence of baseline artifact and drift, because analysis of the PQ and ST segment would be difficult. It'll be hard to say where is the isoelectric line, where is the reference to check if the PQ and ST segments are isoelectric. If the baseline is drifting and changing, then you cannot say for sure if the PQ and ST segments are isoelectric. If you cannot say that, you may not be able to rule out myocardial ischemia, for example. Large baseline drift could lead to clipping of the signal by the amplifiers and the A to D converters. If the signal changes significantly, then it may go out of range of the amplifiers and the A to D converters and get clipped. Power line interference is very common in many biomedical signals, not only the ECG, but also in heart sounds, in EEG, in event-related potentials, everywhere. Even if you ground and take care of the potential of leakage through the chassis of the equipment, the frame of the equipment, there could be some power line artifact getting into your signals. And depending upon the region and the supply of power, it could be 50 or 60 hertz, and there could be also harmonics. If the power line waveform is distorted, there'll be harmonics present at multiples of the basic fundamental frequency. The bandwidth of interest of the ECG is 0.05 to 100 hertz, and certainly that includes the power line frequency at 50 or 60 hertz. So you cannot apply a low-pass filter to remove power line artifact. If you apply a low-pass filter with a cutoff of less than 40 hertz or 50 hertz, you will create excessive smoothing, and the QRS complex will be blurred, and the isoelectric nature of the PQ and ST segments may not be clear. So low-pass filtering will not work. You'll have to do something else, and we will see that later on. Here's an example of an ECG signal where clearly you can see the period of the periodic artifact here along with higher frequency noise. And this is in spite of filters in the acquisition system to reject 60 hertz using a notch filter. In spite of that, there is so much left. If you take the Fourier transform of the signal, you see clearly a big component present at 60 hertz and also at 180 hertz and 300 hertz, which are harmonics. It's a bit unusual, but in this example, this is from a real signal from the Children's Hospital in Winnipeg while we were collecting ECG and heart sound signals. I didn't add these. They were there. The system had a notch filter, but the notch filter could not suppress it beyond minus 10 dB. It's still there. And it is clearly visible here. Maternal interference in fetal ECG. This is a case where you cannot apply any fixed filter because the frequency characteristics are comparable of the signals. They occupy the same band. This is the maternal ECG with 60 hertz, you can see clearly. And this is the maternal ECG obtained using limb leads, where the fetal ECG is not projected. This is the maternal ECG obtained from the abdomen, where you get both the mother's ECG and the ECG of the fetus combined. So by comparing these two, it is possible to say this beat is the mother's heartbeat, that and that, and the others you see in between are the heartbeats of the fetus. Typically, the heart rate of the fetus will be 2 times or maybe a little more as compared to the maternal heart rate. The fetal heart rate could be of the order of 100 to 120. So you see multiple beats. But sometimes it may not be clear if these are superimposed or the P and T waves are superimposing the ECG of the fetus, and it is desirable to cancel the ECG of the mother from the abdominal ECG and get only the fetal ECG out. The advantage, of course, is it is non-invasive external monitoring. And that's the only way it is possible to record the ECG of the fetus until the head of the fetus is exposed, and then you can put scalp electrodes and measure the ECG of the fetus. That'll be just a few minutes to few hours before the delivery of the baby. So if you want to monitor during pregnancy, the abdominal ECG is an easily accessible signal, but it'll give you a combination of the mother's ECG and the fetal ECG. It is possible to get simultaneous channels from the limb ECG, leads 1, 2, and 3 of the mother, where the fetal ECG may not be present, and then by adaptive filtering techniques, it is possible to cancel these. And we will see some techniques for those later on. That paper, by the way, was from the 1970s. Ultrasound was not common at that time. Nowadays, ultrasound is well established. The safety of ultrasound is not questioned anymore, although there are some who question if ultrasound can be applied repeatedly for fetal monitoring, but it is commonly done. And nowadays, you could get the heart rate of the fetal, of the fetus, using some other techniques, and the ECG may not be essential. But there are other techniques available to cancel the maternal ECG from the abdominal ECG to get the fetal ECG also. But that calls for a different technique, which is adaptive filtering, because the two signals occupy the same frequency band. And no band pass or low pass or high pass filtering will separate them. Muscle contraction interference, I mentioned this topic earlier, and in one of our studies, we obtained the knee joint signal from the patella, and we also got extra channels from on the tibia, and we got the muscle sound signal using an accelerometer placed on the rectus femoris muscle. So using multiple channels, we recorded knee joint and the muscle sounds, vibration signals, bandpass filtered them, and they occupy essentially the same bands from about 0 to 500 hertz maximum. We had to cancel them because we wanted to remove the muscle contraction interference, or the VMG, from the VAG signals. And for that purpose, we designed some adaptive filters. Because they occupy the same band, you cannot use bandpass filters or low-pass filters. Here is an illustration of the signals. These are the muscle signals from the rectus femoris. Let me just check the caption for a moment. From the top, it is rectus femoris, mid-patella, tibial tuberosity, and tibial shaft. Okay. The four positions I mentioned on the rectus femoris, on the patella, and these two are on the tibia. This is the muscle signal that is getting transmitted. This was recorded without the movement of the knee. This is recorded with the movement of the knee, with the leg swinging. And this signal, this artifact, appears here. And it appears, this is at the on the rectus femoris muscle. The knee signal is here, and that also goes up the rectus femoris. But the muscle signal that you see clearly here on the rectus femoris itself comes to the patella, comes to the tibia, and also a little bit further down the tibial shaft all the way over here. So the muscle signal is transmitted clearly down the leg. And this is during swinging movement of the leg, one extension and one flexion. And this is recorded without any movement of the leg, but only contraction of the rectus femoris muscle. Let me just check that. Left hand column, just the VMG, and the right hand, yeah. So the left hand is during isometric contraction of only the rectus femoris. This is swinging movement of the leg. So clearly, the muscle signal comes into the knee signal all the way down to the mid-tibial shaft position. And to remove it, we need to recognize, number one, it is coming from the rectus femoris muscle, and then we need to record it simultaneously when we are recording the knee joint sound signals. And then we need an adaptive filter to cancel them, because we don't know when exactly these signals, the interference will appear, and what the frequency characteristics will be. So an adaptive filter is required. So what are the potential solutions to the problem? Each problem will be quite likely a unique problem. So any particular solution that you learn in this course or any other course may not be directly applicable to your experimental situation. However, as I mentioned in the introduction, the experience in solving several problems could help you in identifying the nature of the problem that you are facing and explore possible solutions and design the one that is most appropriate to your situation. So a practical problem encountered by an investigator in the field, such as your own research problem, may not precisely match a problem in the textbook. However, the knowledge of several techniques, the appreciation of the results of their application, and the experience in doing the exercises in this course could possibly help you in designing appropriate and innovative solutions to the new problem that you will face. So that is just the general background to what are artifacts, what are the characteristics of various types of artifacts that you may encounter in biomedical signals, and how you may possibly take the approach of solving the issue. So let's look at a few basic techniques to remove artifacts. We will first consider techniques in the time domain, where you are working with the signal samples in the time domain. Later on, we will consider frequency domain operations. In the analysis of filters, although I said we will treat them as time domain operations, it is quite common to consider the Z transform or the Z transform and the transfer functions of the filters, as well as the frequency response of the filters. So while we say these are time domain filters, the analysis of the filters could very well involve the use of frequency domain transforms and techniques. So we could possibly design filters to remove artifacts, in some cases, using the time domain samples directly implemented as digital filters, which will facilitate online real-time filtering rapidly. The advantage is that spectral characterization of the signal and noise may not be required directly, although you will have to know appropriate properties of the signal and noise so that you can design your filter appropriately. You don't need parametric representation. That's what I mean here. Whereas certain filters designed in the frequency domain would require such characterization. Time domain processing may also be faster than frequency domain filtering and could facilitate online real-time filtering. A basic technique is synchronized averaging, which I mentioned earlier. Linear filters that you might have seen, low-pass, band-pass filters, fail when the signal and noise occupy the same band. The spectra overlap. then you cannot apply a low-pass or band-pass or high-pass filter, such as event-related potentials and EEG. There's no way you can separate them using a band-pass filter or a low-pass filter. And if you can get several observations of the same signal, such as in event-related potentials when you are triggering the response yourself, it becomes possible to do synchronized signal averaging. This is the same as ensemble averaging I mentioned earlier, except now we say the ensemble is synchronized. In general ensemble averaging, there may not be a synchronization between the observations. If they're just ongoing random events, you may record an observation now, another observation later, and yet another tomorrow, and you just put them together and take the average, or compute parameters and average them. In the case of event-related potentials, which I used to illustrate ensemble averages earlier, the responses need to be synchronized with the trigger. Or if you're computing parameters of a cyclostationary signal such as the heart sound, then you will need to align the signal or the derived parameters such as the power spectral density using a trigger so that you're always averaging the characteristics of the same signal component such as the first sound or the second sound or a murmur. So synchronized signal averaging can separate a repetitive signal, not necessarily periodic, but a repetitive signal whose starting point can be identified or is under your control from noise without distorting the signal. The main application is with event-related potentials or somatosensory evoked potentials, and they may be obtained a number of times by applying the same stimulus. Visual flashes or auditory clicks, and the repeated application of the stimulus is under your control. You know when you apply the stimulus and you know the duration of the expected response, and you capture that and trigger again, get the response and align them, and you can average the epochs over multiple observations. The basic idea is that the noise is random with zero mean and uncorrelated with the signal, and then averaging will improve the signal-to-noise ratio. Suppose YKN is one realization of the signal, K going 1 to M representing the ensemble, and N going 1 to capital N represents the time sample index of each observation. So M is the number of copies or events or epochs or realizations that you have recorded. N is the number of samples in each signal. I'm assuming they're the same, but they need not be the same. If you're gathering several hundred realizations of the event-related potential, it is important to align the beginning, but the end point need not be the same. Some could be longer than the others, because towards the end, there might be only noise. But let's assume that you always have the same number of samples in each realization or measurement. Then the modeling, the analysis becomes simpler. YKN is XKN plus eta KN. We will allow the noise to be different from one realization to another, but later on we will make the assumption that noise remains the same. So XKN is the original uncorrupted signal. Eta K is the noise in the kth copy of the signal. When I say copy, it's not the same, but realization, you can say, or recording. And for each instant of time, you add m copies of the signal, so some k going 1 to m of ykn. So it remains a function of time n. So that is equal to the sum of all the xkn plus eta kn. Now we are going to assume that the signal of interest xkn is the same from one realization to another. That is an assumption that may or may not be valid. If it is a flash-evoked response or evoked event-related potential, we assume that for every flash that is given to my eye, the response is the same. And if you repeat it 1,000 times, that every one of them is the same, not considering the noise. If you make that assumption and if it is true, then all of these are exactly the same, all the XKs. So you get M times xn, where xn is the signal that you want. So that is an assumption made. If noise is random, has zero mean and variance sigma square eta, and the distribution, the probability density function of the noise is the same from one repetition to another, one observation to another of the event-related potential, which is almost true because the ambient noise is almost the same, and you do the experiment over a matter of a few seconds. The flashes are repeated several times a second, and even if you do your experiment over a few minutes, you can assume the noise in the environment to be the same. Then, as you average multiple samples of the noise process across the ensemble, you can assume that that average tends to zero as m increases, because the average, the mean value of noise is zero, and the variance of that will be m times sigma square n. You can work that out, take the expectation, and work the variance of this, and that will be m sigma square n. Yes, but the variance of this, the mean reduces, but the variance of the estimate of the mean is increasing. This is the variance of the mean being estimated, not the, well, that is the variance, yes, that's true. As you are gathering more observations, the variance increases when you are averaging across an ensemble. So for that, what you should do is go to this formula and add them m times over and compute the variance using the basic definition of variance. And because you are adding over m observations, the variance will be m sigma square n, where sigma square eta is the variance of one channel of observation of the noise. But what happens is the RMS value of the noise in the average signal is square root of m sigma. Thus, the signal-to-noise ratio actually increases. The variance of the noise increases by this factor, by the factor m. The standard deviation, or the RMS value of the noise, increases by a factor of square root of m. But because the signal is the same, the signal has been strengthened by a factor of m. The signal is strengthened by a factor of m. The noise variance is strengthened by a factor of m2, but the RMS is the root of that. So the signal-to-noise ratio, which is the ratio of the signal amplitude to the RMS value of the noise, is affected by a factor of m divided by root m, which is square root of m. So the signal-to-noise ratio increases by a factor of square root of m. Okay? So the larger the number of samples you average, the larger the gain or increase in the signal-to-noise ratio as compared to one observation of the signal. So if you were to average over 100 observations, you would expect a gain in signal-to-noise ratio of square root of 100 equal to 10. There's a limit in this. The limitation is in this assumption that every time you give a flash or a signal to me, my brain will give the same signal xn. That is not true, because there is a process, there are two processes. One is known as habituation. Habituation is when I have seen something many times, then I know and I can guess it is coming. Suppose you are giving me 20 pulses a second. I know that every 1/20th of a second there will be a pulse coming. So my brain will not give you the same response every time. It will change. And then there is the effect of fatigue. When my system gets tired, it will not produce the same response. So this assumption is not valid. You could reduce the effect of fatigue by giving breaks, let the subject take rest and repeat after some time. You could reduce the effect of habituation by making the stimulus not exactly periodic but stagger a little bit so it is not always at exactly the same position in time in terms of being periodic. So the interpulse interval or interflash interval could be jittered a bit. Then habituation could be offset a little bit, but still there is repeated stimulation and the system gets used to this, and the effect of habituation will change the response from one K to another, and when you average them, you will not get the same. So the gain may not be M, it'll be a little less than M. So here is an example. This is the same as the ensemble I showed earlier, but in a format that is used in clinical practice. This is also from my own signal, visual evoked or event-related potential. So what we have, traces 1 and 2, this and this, are two sample acquisitions from the occipital midline. The earlobes were used as reference, and the left forehead was also, as before, used as reference. And number 3 is the average of 10 successive event-related potentials. And this is the average of 20. So these are two individual observations, average of 10, average of 20. So now you can observe that by averaging all these variations, these noise fluctuations have been removed. Much of the noise here is due to power line artifact. There is significant power line artifact. The stimulus is applied here, but the rate of stimulation, or I should say, the periodicity of stimulation is not precise. And it is not in synchrony with 60 hertz. So the repetition rate, let me go back. I have given that somewhere. I don't have it here. The repetition rate is not made to be the frequency of the power line divided by any integer, so that you may make the repetition rate something like 25.3 pulses a second. And it'll not be in synchrony with 60 hertz. Otherwise, the 60 hertz component may also be in synchrony in phase from one observation to another and will not be canceled. As long as the trigger is not in synchrony with any fraction of 60 hertz, then even if there is 60 hertz noise present, it'll be out of phase from one observation to another, and 60 hertz, although structured, will be canceled by synchronous averaging. Random noise, of course, is removed by averaging as the mean tends to zero. What you saw here is only over 20 samples. This is over only 20, but if you repeat over 100 or so stimuli, you get an even cleaner signal. But just by comparing this response with the individual responses, you see a significant reduction in the artifacts. What is of interest here is the first positive peak, that is called P120, which occurs approximately 120 milliseconds after the stimulus. It is expected in this range. This is 125 milliseconds, that is 250 milliseconds. And this box is 10 microvolts. The technologist has to recognize this peak, which is a positive peak, approximately near 120 milliseconds, and it is called P120 because of that. For normal adults, the latency of the first positive peak after the stimulus is 120 milliseconds. For me, it is, I think I have it somewhere else. I'll give you the exact number later. The negative trough before that is called N80, because that is expected around 80 milliseconds. And the one aft, negative trough after the P120 is called N145. That is expected approximately at 145 milliseconds. But of course, these are not always at the same position. They vary from individual to individual. So these have to be fairly clear. And to see them, the noise has to be removed. Otherwise, you cannot see where is the positive, most important positive peak and the negative troughs before and after. So individual traces will not facilitate the observance of these features. These were marked by a technologist trained in this topic. Even after averaging 10, it is a bit hard to see these peaks and troughs. So in this case, N80 was at 85.7, P120 was at 100.7, and N145 was at 117 milliseconds. If the latency is much more than what is expected, if N120 appears at 150, then something could be suspected to be wrong. But if it is a little before, I was told I'm normal, so I was happy I passed this test. So in this example, averaging 10 and 20 flashes gives rise to signals that are fairly clean where you can observe the negative and positive features. I forget the flash rate, but it's in the book. I have mentioned somewhere the flash rate. Can you check that, please? The algorithmic description for this is you obtain a number of realizations of the signal or event, determine the reference point. In the case of visual stimuli, you know because your machine is applying that. In the case of ECG heart sounds, you can use the QRS. You extract parts of the signal corresponding to the event and add them to a buffer. Various parts may have different durations, it's not important, or they may have exactly the same duration. Alignment of the copies at trigger points is important. The tail ends may not be the same. Divide the result by the number of events, so that's all. Very simple, but is effective. I did that, I did this, and we did this. Do you see that? Give me a moment, I want to give that number because it's important, excuse me. No, I don't have it here. Sorry, I thought I had it here. So I don't have the repetition rate noted. Okay. Now suppose you have only one channel of a signal that is repetitive, such as the ECG. It is possible to apply synchronized averaging by identifying the events and cutting the copies. And this can be done to get one clean waveform of an ECG signal from a single channel of the ECG, where to obtain the trigger points, you can take a sample QRS complex and do correlation. So in this example, I'll go to the example and then come back. Here is a signal that is repeating the ECG waveform, but it's not exactly periodic. It is quasi-periodic. If I were to cut one sample of the QRS and take that as my template and then do a cross-correlation by running it across and comparing the template with the signal and I slide it, I get the cross-correlation between the template and the signal. And then whenever the template is aligned with a QRS complex, I get a large value in the output. And again, when it aligns here, I get a large value. So whenever the template aligns with something that is similar, you get a large value in the output. Of course, you also get large values when the QRS complex matches the T wave because there is some similarity, not exactly the same, but you do get a fairly large value of 0.6 or so. But this is on a scale of 0 to 1, plus minus 1, and you get the value of almost 1 when the template matches each QRS complex. And then you can average, you can cut these points and average them, and you get an averaged signal with reduced noise. This is ECG cycle number 3, cycle number 5. This is mainly 60 Hertz noise with some high frequency noise. But as long as the points that are extracted using the ECG QRS complex are not in synchrony with the 60 Hertz waveform, the 60 Hertz noise is also reduced. This is a result of averaging 11 cycles where the noise has been reduced. But of course, this results in only one QRS complex. It's not filtering the entire signal. So if you just want to study the wave shape of the typical QRS complex, you could do this. Yeah? This is assuming that the heart rate is not varying significantly in the short time. Yes, you cannot do this over many hours with the heart rate changing. If the heart rate becomes very high compared to, let's say, if it changes from 60 beats a minute to 120, then this interval is reduced. And then you cannot do the averaging. If you're averaging over 20, 30, 40 beats over, let's say, 1 minute, or even 60 beats over 1 minute, and assuming that the heart rate is the same over that period, then this interval or the duration of the QRST will not change much. That's right, that's a good point. Within a small range, let's say from 60 beats a minute to 70, 80, 90 beats a minute, the change is essentially in the interval from one beat to the next. That interval is reduced. The R to R interval is reduced. The PQRST will remain the same. But if you compare ECG at 60 beats a minute with ECG at 120 minutes of the same subject, then this interval will reduce. So in this example, what I did was I cut a sample QRS complex of duration 86 milliseconds. In this case, the signal was sampled at 1,000 hertz, and that's 86 samples. I used the first beat and then applied template matching, where cross-correlation is computed. This formula, there is a problem in the formula in the book. This is the correct formula as implemented in MATLAB. So you'll have to note this correction. You take xn and subtract the mean. You take y, and you have to align the template on the signal. You have to shift the template such that it is aligned with the ECG at a given point k. K is the sample at which you are computing the cross-correlation, and the template is placed in such a manner that it is causal. That is, you are using only samples before the position. So if you drop these other points, other shift factors involved, you're taking the signal x, you're taking the signal y, you're subtracting the mean here, and then you are then taking the dot product over the n samples in the template. You're comparing the template has n samples, you're extracting n samples from the signal, and you're doing a dot product after subtracting the mean, because the baseline could change. You're normalizing here then by the geometric mean of the total energy in the signal part of n samples and the template part of n samples. Yk bar is the average of y in that interval. So here, yk bar is the average of the part of y that is used in template matching. X is the template which is cut, the QRS complex. X bar is the average value of X. The operation is causal, and you cannot use the first n samples because you cannot align the template in a causal manner. And K is the time index of Y at which the template is placed. There is averaging over the n samples within the template. So if you were to apply a threshold of 0.9, the 12 beats here will be detected, and then you cut. Portions, align them and average them. But the ECG is more commonly used as a trigger to segment and average some other signal, such as the heart sound, and we will see such examples later. So this is not important in practice, but illustrates an important feature that could be extracted from cyclostationary signals or repeating signals. And essentially, to explain this, what is happening is, suppose this is the ECG signal, I cut this part, and that is my template, and I take this template, and for each position, I place it on the signal and compute the correlation value. I'm correlating this on a point-by-point basis and shifting. So you have to run this across the signal, selecting at each point in time as many samples as here. N values, N samples. And whenever the signal encounters something similar, you are expecting a large output. In practice, you will not see this. You will see some other variation due to other things that happen in the signal, other events. But you may still get a clear peak.